Good day, listeners. This is your host, Michael Martins, with the Martins Critical Review, broadcasting this afternoon from a generally sunny day here in South Central British Columbia. In today's episode, we continue our investigative series into the actual science behind the Earth's ever-changing climate and continue to provide clear evidence to counter the bogus mainstream alarmist narrative. Today, we'll examine another poster child of the alarmist movement, the Great Barrier Reef of Australia. Joining us is Dr. Peter Ridd, PhD. Dr. Ridd obtained his doctoral degree in physics from the James Cook University in 1980 and is a former professor and head of physics. Dr. Ridd's focus while at James Cook was coastal oceanography, the effects of sedimentation on coral reefs, instrument development, geophysical sensing, and past and future climates. Dr. Ridd has published more than 100 scientific papers in international science journals and supervised many successful PhD students. His most recent book is Reef Heresy: Science, Research, and the Great Barrier Reef. When warming alarmists grossly misled people about the status of Australia's Great Barrier Reef, Dr. Ridd spoke up. He wrote an opinion piece in the January 2018 issue of the Marine Pollution Bulletin, which was challenged the prevailing propaganda related to the condition of the Great Barrier Reef. This essay drew attention to what Dr. Ridd argued was a reproducibility crisis and also to the validity of specific papers on the topic. As a result, Dr. Ridd's employer, James Cook University, took a number of disciplinary measures against him, and ultimately, after a lengthy court battle, he was dismissed. Following the conclusion of his legal battle in 2021, Dr. Ridd has accepted an invitation to join the Institute of Public Affairs as an adjunct fellow, without salary, to lead a newly established Project for Real Science. The project's aims are to improve science quality assurance, build on the IPA's existing research programs, and to support academics speaking out for integrity in science and research. Dr. Ridd, it's a privilege to be able to speak with you today. Thank you so much for your time, and welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
Excellent. So first off, I must state that I have tremendous respect for you and your courage to pursue the truth and real science in light of all the opposition that you've faced. Where does this personal strength come from?
I'm not sure. I mean, you have to have family and a very understanding wife behind you. But I think it's just that you just get angry when you see things which are not true, promulgated again and again and again. You just got to do something. It's just something inside you that forces you to do it.
Well, that's excellent. And, again, thank you for doing that. And, of course, it was not an easy process to go through in many, many months and a lot of smear campaigns and so forth. So maybe let's step back a little bit and give the listeners an idea about who the young Dr. Ridd was and what motivated that young person to pursue physics and ultimately onto marine physics.
Well, physics is sort of my love. Physics is beautiful, to see Maxwell's equations and being able to get the wave equation for light out of that is just wonderful. So I was always interested in physics, but coming in from North Queensland, which is sort of a fairly remote part of the world, the traditional physics jobs weren't there. So I ended up in marine science. There's a lot of physics in marine science. It's not just marine biology. And actually that was quite important because having a different background to the normal biology background makes you look at things in possibly a different way to a biologist.
Interesting. Any examples of that spring to mind?
Well, you see, you're not emotional about it. Most marine biologists go into marine biology because they love biology and the, dolphins and corals since they were 5 years old. I've ended up in marine science by accident. So I can look at data, I think, probably more objectively than some of the biologists, not all of them, by a long sea mile. So when I look at the data, I don't see a huge problem with the Great Barrier Reef, whereas I watch biologists look at things and they seem to get completely the wrong impression on many occasions.
Interesting. And I understand, listening to one of your interviews, that you suffer from seasickness, so that must have been a bit of a challenge overcoming that through your career.
But I can take the tablets. I'm all right. I don't particularly enjoy being out on the ocean. I think the Great Barrier Reef is utterly, stunningly beautiful. But, when you're on a month-long oceanographic cruise in rough weather, it's not all that brilliant.
That's when you're hoping for the stability of land at that point.
Yeah.
So I'd like to unpack a quote and learn more about your thoughts on it. And the quote is, the 2020 summit exposed the hypocritical, illogical, and treacherous nature of most people in the modern green movement. It has been hijacked by a quasi-religious ideology, which makes it ineffective at solving the big problems we face, and the environment is suffering as a result. The Greens nowadays are less of an environmental movement and more of an extreme left-wing conglomeration devoted primarily to social justice issues.
Well, that's absolutely spot on. I mean, I couldn't have put it better myself. That I used to vote for Green, you know, in the 1980s when they were a genuine conservation group, and they just rapidly morphed in the 1990s to sort of an extreme left-wing organisation that actually doesn't worry about the real big environmental problems. And we are losing huge amounts of rainforest every year in the Southeast Asia and other places, New Guinea. And it barely rates a mention because we're worried about climate change and the Great Barrier Reef, which, in my view, are minor environmental problems. So, yes, the Greens have started as a force for good in the 1960s and 70s and have become a force for bad.
Yeah, and that's a statement that I often make to a lot of folks that challenge me on my position on climate change, that I'm an avid outdoorsman, I am a conservationist, and if I thought for a moment that any of these alarmist ideas had some legitimacy, I'd be on the other side of the fence, but clearly they don't. And, this green agenda is nothing about the salvation of ecosystems or humanity. It's about the imprisonment and the degradation of that. And as you suggest, these tropical rainforests are being cut down to plant palm for biofuels. And, you know, here in Canada, we're having our very low productivity old growth forests, which may take 80 to 150 years for that ecosystem to come back into its condition to feed wood pellet mills for energy. I mean, it makes no sense. It's preposterous.
Exactly. And in Australia, I mean, the big problem we have here, which nobody knows about, I'd be surprised if almost any of your listeners know about it, is the problem of feral animals and noxious weeds. But Australia's got a very unique biota, and things that have come from overseas are spreading terribly all over the country. We've got cats, we've got camels, we've got foxes doing damage, but noxious weeds is a huge problem. But you can hardly get a brass rah zoo out of the government to fight these massive environmental issues because we're too worried about building windmills and supposedly saving the Great Barrier Reef, which is actually in wonderful condition.
Yes. And of course, driving the price of electricity up and the uncertainty of the power supply, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly. Yeah.
So when did you become an outspoken critic of the mainstream climate alarmism movement? And was there an aha moment that predicated that move?
Well, what had happened was I'd been working on the Great Barrier Reef, mostly looking at sediment. So we built the first instruments to measure sediment basically from farms, washing down the rivers, supposedly smothering the coral. And we built the first instruments to be able to measure that for long periods. And we were able to demonstrate that it wasn't a problem. But yet, all our work and the work of the geologists I worked with was being completely ignored by the mainstream of the science. And I kept on thinking, you know, why is this happening? But I thought that the rest of science was probably solid and all the other threats to the reef, like climate change, was solid. And it wasn't until I gave a seminar actually on the Great Barrier Reef, and a well-known skeptic came up to me who I worked with for a very long time, Bob Carter, and said, "You think the science of the Great Barrier Reef is bad, you should start to look at some of the stuff on climate change." So for the first time, this is probably in 2003-04, I started to really delve into it. And after about 6 months of going into the geological history and the physics of the radiative transfer, I started to realize, my goodness, this is nowhere near as solid as I thought. And that was a huge shock to me. But it took quite a while for that to occur.
And that in that reading that you did, was that material that the layperson either has access to or would understand, or would that be sort of above the average person's capacity to understand?
Some of it, the geological literature, you know, the Holocene climatic optimum, which was 1 or 2 degrees hotter than it is today, that's easy to understand. The physics of radiative transfer and the way that the atmosphere works is not easy to understand. I mean, I must say that probably took me 2 to 3 years to really understand that as well as I can. In fact, I took the step of of deciding I'm going to teach this radiative transfer in a fourth year university course, because there's nothing like teaching something to force you to understand it. But that's that is very, very complicated, that most people will never be able to really get a handle on. And you've ultimately got to trust the scientists. And that's a big problem, because I'm afraid nowadays you cannot trust the scientific institutions.
And is the radiative transfer, is that an issue of the heat capacity of the atmosphere versus the oceans and so forth?
Not really. It's the way that the infrared radiation in particular goes from the bottom of the atmosphere to the top of the atmosphere. You often hear these analogies, like the carbon dioxide is like a blanket over the earth, and it's just not right. You've actually got to go into the equations of radiative transfer, which are very, very complicated, to really understand that properly. You've also got to understand how the models work, which I do, because you know I did a lot of hydrodynamic modeling as an oceanographer, so it's not a big step to go to atmospheric modeling. The role of clouds, how cloud forms, because one of the huge holes in our knowledge is about clouds. It's incredible how little we know about clouds. And yet the formation of clouds is a massive effect on in terms of how much light is incoming sunlight is reflected, and could have a huge effect on the climate in terms of stabilizing it. Almost certainly does.
Interesting. So obviously much more detailed science than simply pointing the finger at a single solitary molecule.
That's right. If you really want to look at the way the atmosphere works, it's a complicated system, which we really don't understand particularly well, except I think we can say it's a relatively stable system that is unlikely to run away the way the models seem to predict.
Sure. And certainly none of the predictions have come to pass, or, you know, the predictive capacity of those models is essentially zero.
No, exactly. Essentially zero. They are not fit for purpose. I mean, they were predicting that we'd get cooling in the 1970s, because it was cooling in the up to the 1970s from about the 1940s. And at the moment, no, I think that they're a good effort. They're very complicated. They do their best, but they've got so many unconstrained parameters in them. And as a physicist, that's always a bad thing. You know, in physics, for the laws of gravity to predict the way the Earth goes around the sun, there's one unconstrained parameter, the gravitational constant. For models, there's literally dozens, if not hundreds, of unconstrained parameters, and you can fiddle with those to get almost any response you like out of the climate system. So that makes them not fit for purpose.
Yes, and then of course the resolution of the 5 degrees latitude, 5 degrees longitude, the squares. I mean, that's not the, and we don't have enough data points to reflect that. I mean, it's a very, very poorly developed model. I mean, it's not as robust as it needs to be by a long shot.
No, and we don't actually understand how clouds form. It's actually a huge mystery, the way that you go from a lot of water vapor to a small drop to a bigger drop to a bigger drop to rain falling out of a cloud. And if you don't understand the water cycle, and remembering that water is by far the most important greenhouse gas, if you can't really predict the water cycle properly, then your model is just not necessarily going to be reliable to predict well into the future. You can do things like weather forecasts, because you can do enough forecasts to tweak the parameters that over a short period it seems to work. But for longer periods, it becomes much more problematic, because we don't have enough data to tweak those parameters in a way that is sensible.
Yes. And then, of course, it seems like the alarmists and their modelers have completely ignored the Schwarzschild and Planck curves of the various atmospheric elements and their absorptive capabilities. And, you know, I think they predicted back in, I believe it was the 1880s, that a doubling of CO2 from 400 to 800 parts per million has a negligible effect. And a further doubling has maybe a 1 or 2% enhanced heat capacity.
I don't entirely agree there. I think that actually of the one thing in the models that is probably reasonably accurate is the radiative transfer mechanisms in there. You're right in the sense that, you know, there is a sort of a logarithmic effect, that the more you go up, the more you increase the carbon dioxide, the less the effect. But my main objections in the models is actually the way that the water cycle is dealt with, clouds and those sorts of things. I think that they are the bigger hole than the actual radiative transfer equations.
Sure. And they're essentially ignored. The effects of clouds are not even calculated. Is that correct?
No, that they try to take them into account, certainly, but they're done in such a crude way. I mean, you said that the world is broken into a squares of a few degrees, whereas your average cloud is much, much smaller than that. So you have these horrific parameterizations to try to take that into account. And for weather forecasts, you can get out to a couple of weeks, perhaps. But that's because we've been able to tweak those parameters from, every time there's a weather forecast, which is every day, we can see how that worked and tweak the parameters to make them better and better. But we are moving into a situation which we don't have a great deal of data for. We don't have any data for, which is an increasing in the carbon dioxide. So we're moving from a situation where the model is going from predicting things which are sort of within the normal data that we've got to something that's entirely different. And the only way you can actually rely on a model under those circumstances, if you know all the physics, right? And we don't know all the physics to be able to do that. You can use statistical models if you don't know the physics. And essentially, the weather forecast models use a lot of statistics. We've got so much weather data that we can essentially run a statistical model to work out some sort of prediction. We use that with the dynamic models. But there's no statistics on the increase in the CO2 because, well, the CO2 is very gently increasing. We don't have lots and lots of data points on that.
Right. So in this next section here, Dr. Ridd, I have a series of questions, and if you can supply us with a short answer, that would be great. So we'll begin with the first question. Is planet Earth presently experiencing a climate emergency?
Certainly not an emergency.
Okay. Is there any conclusive evidence to prove anthropogenic climate change?
I think that it's conclusive that there is a small effect from the increasing CO2. Yes, but whether it's that's a very different statement to saying that it's an emergency or that it's dangerous.
Okay. And are sea levels rising and atolls sinking underwater?
Sea levels are rising very, very gently. They're not increasing. The rate of rise is not increasing. And if anything, the atolls are getting bigger, as you'd expect, because that's what atolls actually do. It's been
Sure.
known for centuries, well, a century.
And is the Great Barrier Reef dying, or is this ecosystem in danger?
No, the Great Barrier Reef is the most wonderful, pristine, unspoilt ecosystem on Earth, and it just beggars belief that we've managed to convince everybody, including all the poor school children who hear about it, that it's on its last legs.
Interesting. And are the oceans warming, and are they warming at an unprecedented rate?
They are warming, but we don't have enough data to say whether it's unprecedented. It's very slow, very, very slow.
So there's a slight warming. What sort of, do we have a temperature? Do we have a number or range there?
Well, the deep ocean, I need to stick my neck out. It might have been 0.1 of a degree if you go down a few hundred meters. The surface ocean might have warmed by half a degree to three quarters of a degree. One of the problems is the historic data is not reliable. There's been a lot of, and this sounds terrible, there's a lot been a lot of fudging of the data, of all the meteorological data, but also the oceanographic data, the historic stuff. But it's a small rise, half a degree, three quarters of a degree. This is well within the bounds of natural variability.
And I would say that a 0.1 degree difference would also be an instrumentation error potentially as well.
No, that the instruments in the deep ocean, they would be accurate to probably 1,000th of a degree. And even if the worst case scenario, 0.01 of a degree. So I think there's no doubt that the deeper ocean, as measured by the Argo floats and various other things, is getting a little bit warmer. But the thing that the geologists will teach you is that the Earth changes. It's a varying system. You don't expect it to stay the same. If it wasn't heating up, it would be cooling down. It's not going to be staying the same.
Sure.
And that what happens is people. Oh, something's changed, therefore it's anthropogenic. Whereas a geologist will look at it, and I've worked with a lot of geologists, they'll say, well, of course it's changing. That's what climate systems do. That's what the Earth does. That's what biology does.
Certainly, and I would imagine that the deep oceans are more likely heating from underwater volcanic activity than atmospheric warming.
Well, there's certainly some of that, and I personally think that the the heating from below is not well enough constrained. I mean, there's a lot of volcanoes down there, and we really don't know a lot about what's going on there. So I think that's an open question. I wouldn't necessarily agree with your statement, but I think it raises an interesting point.
Okay. And are the oceans acidifying to a dangerous level?
They are not acidifying. The pH is falling very, very slightly, maybe by 0.1 of a pH unit. And they're not getting anywhere near acidity. And it is something that worries me a little bit more than certainly more than the CO2 on temperature, because there is some data indicating that calcifying organisms like corals do slow down as the pH reduces.
Okay. And is the chemical CO2 the leading or singular cause of climate change on Earth?
No, we frankly don't understand the massive climate changes that have occurred in the past. Yes, we know about the Milankovitch cycles, you know, the wobble of the Earth's rotation, all these sorts of things. But how that actually translates to the huge swings in climate we've seen over, you know, the last 100,000 years, millions of years, we don't understand that. But CO2 is certainly not the major driver of that. There must be other things going on, because, you know, there's periods where CO2 will stay more or less the same, but the climate changed. So something else happened.
Yes, yes. And what is your strongest disproof of the alarmist narrative of human-caused global warming?
I think the geological data is the where you can show that the Holocene climatic optimum, you know, 5,000 years ago, it was a degree or two hotter, right? What caused that? It certainly wasn't us. But the main one that you should start to be skeptical is that clearly the quality assurance systems used in the science is not up to scratch. And I'm not going to buy a car if I don't think the quality assurance systems aren't up to scratch. So I buy a Toyota, right? And what we're buying with this climate science is junk, right? It hasn't been built properly. The scientists have been giving the wrong impression about the reliability, which makes me even more suspicious about it. And that's the main reason why you should be skeptical, because the quality assurance systems simply aren't fit for purpose.
So more of a Holden than a Toyota.
Yes, and of course Holden went broke.
There we go. And so will reducing atmospheric CO2 then save the human civilization?
Well, no, because it's not doomed. Well, not from CO2. It might be doomed from other things, but it's not doomed from CO2.
Yes. And then, of course, the alarmists love this unprecedented term. Are we seeing this present change as unprecedented in the history of the Earth or the history of humanity?
Well, I think there's been an unprecedented use in the word unprecedented. Look, it's just overused ridiculously. And again, it's indicative of people trying much too hard. They're exaggerating things which are supposedly unprecedented, which clearly aren't. When you see that, when you see a scientist effectively tell something which is untrue, I won't say they lied, but they certainly said something untrue, then you've got to say, well, there's a problem here. There's obviously a systemic problem in the whole scientific institutions, and you're in a horrific situation where you wonder what you can believe, if you can believe anything. Now, in physics, in proper physics, and in proper chemistry, you can believe just about everything that you're told. But in these more ideological areas where the science is nowhere near as well constrained, you end up in a stage where you just don't know what to believe. That's a horrific situation.
Yes, yes. And is the total solar irradiance an important component of the Earth's climate?
Well, it's fundamental. Obviously, how fast what the sun does is hugely important, but it's also the details of what happens with the sun. You know, there's massive changes in the very high energy, you know, ultraviolet radiation that comes from the sun. We know the sun varies with the 11-year solar cycle, sunspot cycle. We don't know about lots of other things that goes on. We don't know the effect of cosmic rays. So there's a whole lot of things that are going on with radiation, which we don't understand. And I think which are, well, they're ignored too much by the IPCC.
Right. And then are you in agreement with the most recent research indicating that we're headed towards a grand modern solar minimum, perhaps as severe as the Maunder minimum and at least as impactful as the Dalton?
Look, I think it's possible, but I actually don't necessarily trust those predictions of what the sun's going to do, because we don't actually understand the sun a great deal either. It is possible, you know, it is possible we're going into much lower sunspots, but do you trust those models any more than you trust the climate models? Possibly a little bit, but no, I think we just wait and see what it does. But it could. We certainly could go to a period where we have almost no sunspots, and we'll probably get a much colder climate from that. And that is a seriously scary situation.
Yes, I mean, certainly a cooling trend would be much more impactful to the survival of humanity than a warming trend.
Much, much more so. Yeah.
And of course, you know, we mentioned the Holocene warming. I mean, we've had some more recent warming issues, the Roman warming period, the medieval warming period, and those were at one point called climate optima. And somehow now the fact that we had warming periods has been expunged from history.
Precisely. And when you see that, you think, well, what can I trust now? And the fact that, for example, that, you know, plants grow much faster with a doubling in carbon dioxide, that we're already seeing an increase in productivity, especially in dry countries like Australia, the wheat belt in Australia, very dry. That will be experiencing an improvement in productivity because of that better water utilization caused by increasing carbon dioxide. But this is glossed over. It's a huge advantage, right? Maybe it doesn't make up for some of the disadvantages of a warming climate, but why do they gloss this over and ignore it and not teach the school children about it?
Yes, yes. And the final question of this segment here, Dr. Ridd, could you, in your professorship role, could you assign a letter grade based on the climate alarmists' predictions and modeling when compared to the actual evidence?
Well, you know, is it F or is it Z? I don't know. It's, you just can't rely on it.
Yeah, yeah. So leaving that segment, we're moving on. Before we dive into the details pertaining to the present condition of the Great Barrier Reef, it would be great to provide the listeners with some basic science on corals. What are these structures? How long have they existed? Where are they distributed geographically? And what sort of environmental conditions do they exist and thrive within?
Well, of course, corals like it hot, right? The hotter the better, basically. The best corals live in the hottest part of the world. They've been around for a couple hundred million years at least. Because they make a calcium carbonate skeleton, which is like concrete, they build things called reefs. So over a million years, they can rise up from the seabed. Of course, the sea level is going up and down at the same time, so that complicates things. And they form things called coral reefs, which are basically piles of dead rubble. A coral reef is built on the ancestors of its dead, the dead ancestors, basically. An important thing about corals, which is often not known, this comes to this bleaching thing, is that a coral, which is an individual little animal, and there's a lot of those to make a coral bommy, and then a lot of those make a coral reef. But each of the little coral animals has living inside it an algae, which takes energy from the sun. It's a symbiotic relationship. And this is one of the reasons why corals can deal with climate change so really incredibly well, because they can actually change the type of algae living inside themselves to deal with hotter or colder water. But basically, corals grow faster in the hotter water. There are corals in the north of Canada. There's corals in the north of Scotland. They grow very slowly there. The best corals live in places like Northern Australia and around Indonesia and Papua New Guinea.
Okay. And so let's examine this phenomenon of coral bleaching. You've touched base on it here, but what processes are taking place, and is this bleaching event a reason for long-term concern?
It's something we should be interested in. And I think when it first happened, yeah, we should have been a bit concerned about it because we didn't actually understand what's going on. But now after 30 years of research, we understand that firstly, bleaching doesn't always kill the coral. In fact, usually bleaching doesn't kill the coral. And what actually is happening here is that the coral it chucks out the algae that lives inside it, which gives it its color. So it goes white. And that's why they call it bleaching. But what will often happen is that the coral will then take back an algae, these are just floating around in the water, a different type of algae, they call it zooxanthellae, which will make it more used to or better adapted to higher temperatures or lower temperatures, because you can actually get bleaching from low temperatures. So what bleaching is, an adaptive strategy to deal with different temperatures. And this actually is the irony that corals, far from being these delicate canaries which will fall over at a half a degree increase in temperature, which is really all we've seen in the world's oceans, it's actually incredibly adaptable to massive changes in temperature, more adaptive than almost any other organism. For something on land to change to a warmer, to be able to adapt and evolve to a warmer climate, it needs to go through many cycles of evolution. The offspring, the genes of the offspring get passed on, and after 20 generations, it can deal with hotter temperature. All the coral has to do is change the zooxanthellae, which can do in about a couple of months during a bleaching event, and it's good to go for 1 or 2 degrees hotter. So it's just incredible that these corals, which are the best adaptive organism to temperature changes, is being held up as a poster child for the dangers of climate change.
Very interesting. So it's almost a future-proofing mechanism as the coral is triggered by a trend in its environment. It has the ability to adapt to that environment. And if it becomes colder again, it would discharge the zooxanthellae and find ones that are... Yeah, so it's... I mean, and obviously, if they've existed over the last 200 million years, they've experienced much greater fluctuations in temperature as well as historic rise and fall of sea levels.
That's true, but it's even more basic than that. If you're a coral, right, it produces a coral spawn, a little egg, a fertilized egg, which floats around in the water. It could float for a couple hundred or even 1,000 kilometers and end up in a place with a completely different climate. Mm. So a coral that spawns in the southern Great Barrier Reef could drift up to the northern Great Barrier Reef where the water is 1 or 2 degrees hotter. Well, you need a different zooxanthellae in the hotter waters. So you're taking whatever's the best zooxanthellae up there. So the life cycle of it means that being able to deal with different temperature just makes this shuffling of the zooxanthellae or the algae a really great strategy, which it's used for a couple hundred million years.
Interesting. And I'm not sure in Australia, but certainly in regions around the Caribbean, many islands are built on old coral structures, and in fact, that material is used as blocks for buildings. So, you know, we have examples that these reefs have shifted in location and water depths over time as well.
Massively. Yeah, so not just on the Caribbean. The Great Barrier Reef, if you go back 20,000 years when the sea level was 100 metres lower, the Great Barrier Reef didn't exist. So the reef is comprised of 3,000 reefs, which are piles about 100 metres high of dead coral. And if you drop the sea level, well, these are in the air. So they're covered in trees and grass. And if you walked over them, as the Aboriginal people certainly did, they would have seen this old coral. So you see these massive changes, and the corals dealing with these changes over geological and lesser timescales.
Okay. And of course, those will move as ocean levels rise or fall. Their distribution geographically is going to move in relation to the water.
That's right. So as the sea level rose, and it rose incredibly rapidly over a few thousand years, about 15,000 years ago, the corals recolonized these areas which had previously been trees and grass. And they did it was incredible, the changes. The coastline of this part of Australia here was receding at about 50 meters per year. 50 meters per year, right? That's how fast the sea level was rising. Now, at the moment, the water level is rising by, couple of millimeters a year, and the changes we're seeing now are just minuscule compared with what the corals have dealt with in the past. And by the way, the sea level has fallen on this coast and most parts of the world in the last 5,000 years, and that killed quite a lot of coral because it exposed a lot of the coral to the air. That's another thing that's often not known. The biggest loss of coral in the last few thousand years on the Great Barrier Reef was due to sea level fall over the last few thousand years.
Interesting, interesting. And of course, we would have experienced some of that during the Maunder minimum, where ice formed and the sea levels receded to some degree because of the mini ice age that we experienced.
Well, possibly. I'm not au fait on that, on the sea level over that, but certainly that's what you'd expect. As
Yes.
things get colder, the sea level will fall. As the temperature goes up, the sea level will rise.
Yes. So am I correct in my understanding that the annual data on coral cover for the Great Barrier Reef, produced by the Australian Institute of Marine Science, shows that the amount of the coral reef is at record high levels presently?
Yep, the Great Barrier Reef is presently has more coral on it than since records began in the mid-1980s when I was working at Ames when that first started. This is not a statistic that you will hear on the radio. I've been fact-checked on this and they sort of begrudgingly disagree with me that yes, I'm sort of right, but you just need to add up the numbers. We're at record high coral cover this year, so go figure.
Interesting. So, I mean, obviously, that begs the question, how can this be, given all the press highlighting the doom and gloom stories marketed by the reef science and management agencies and the institutions behind them, that the reef is in fact dying before our eyes?
That's right. I mean, we've supposedly had three unprecedented mass bleaching events which killed a huge amount of coral in the last 5 or 6 years, but we've got record high coral cover. So something's wrong here. And this is why I think that the Great Barrier Reef, much more even than climate change, is demonstrating the unreliability of the scientific institutions. At least with climate change, since the late 1970s, there has been an increase in temperature, right? We can argue about further back. But there has been an increase in temperature over the last 50 years. So you've got to ask the question, what has caused that? But with the Great Barrier Reef, there is no reduction in the coral cover. There is no reduction in the growth rate. The Great Barrier Reef is still in wonderful condition. So where is the problem to even start with here? Whereas at least with the climate change thing, well, you've got to explain a temperature change. Was it natural? Is it anthropogenic?
Yes. So are we witnessing more junk science here, where the survey methodology in particular is creating a data collection error?
Well, actually, in this case, the data collection is done very well. Well, there are some problems with it, but by and large, it's done quite well. There are other data sets on the reef, the coral growth rate, which I have problems with. But in here, I'm using the data from the Australian Institute of Marine Science, their own data, where they survey 100 or so reefs every year. They swim around it and look at the coral. So using their own data set, we're at record high coral cover. It'd be like in climate change, the world is warming from climate change. If the average temperature this year was a record low ever, right? That's what we got for the Great Barrier Reef. We're at record high coral cover. So why are we worrying about the Great Barrier Reef?
Yeah, interesting. Interesting. So are there other sources of error, or is this simply fraud in terms of the misrepresentation of the information that's been collected?
It's just misrepresentation, or it's not even misrepresentation. It's just we refuse to report the good news. It's like we refuse to report that lots of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere will be making plants grow better and our crops will be growing better. And it's greening the Sahel in the sub-Saharan Africa. It's greening the centre of Australia. We're not going to report that. And we're not going to report that the Great Barrier Reef has got record high coral cover.
So it's almost a misrepresentation via omission.
Yes, that's what it is, and of course, it's not just the media that are at fault for this. The scientific organisations bury this good news whenever they can, or they'll have some weaselly excuse. So, what's used here about the record high coral cover is they say, "Oh yes, but it's just one major event away from a catastrophe," which is true, right? We could have a big cyclone, hurricane, go through the Great Barrier Reef. And a big hurricane, if it has the correct track, can literally destroy almost all the coral on about a half or a third of the reef. So you have a massive crash in the amount of coral. And that happened in 2009, 10, 11, right? So yes, we are one major event away from a catastrophe from the reef, but it will grow back. It's like a bushfire. Bleaching is like bushfire. A bit of coral dies, it grows back.
Interesting. And it's obviously a very dynamic and robust natural system.
It's a hugely dynamic system. Of course, this is what makes it a poster child because every few years, a massive amount of coral dies. No doubt about it, right? Huge amounts of coral dies all the time. I often say coral doesn't die one by one, you know, of old age. It gets wiped out by a cyclone, and like a whole reef will get wiped out, and all the reefs around them. Or a plague of starfish will wipe out all the coral. Or a bleaching event will wipe out a little bit of the coral. It's not usually the worst effect. It doesn't die one by one. It dies in these mass events, which is great for photographs, which will go all around the world with pictures of white coral and a bit of algal slime on it. Proof again that yet again, we've lost half the coral. How many times have I heard that we've lost half the coral on the Great Barrier Reef? Well, you can't keep losing half the coral more than twice, you know, unless it's a geometric progression rather than arithmetic.
There we go. And then, of course, mainstream media is also promoting the negative effects of sedimentation on the reef from agricultural runoff. And I understand that you've provided significant scientific evidence to show that this is a fallacy. Can you unpack this issue for us, please?
Yeah, well, so we invented the instruments to measure the effect of sediment on reefs. And you know, it was a good hypothesis. All the extra sediment coming down from erosion on farms, is it killing the reef? And we were able to demonstrate completely unequivocally that it's not. It doesn't actually get out to the main Great Barrier Reef itself. The Great Barrier Reef is, you know, 50 to 100 kilometres off the coast mostly. And you can, the geologists can look at it and see that, well, the sediment just doesn't get out there. And our measurements on the inshore reef demonstrated even there, it has absolutely no effect. But the farmers are blamed. And there's very stringent legislation that's been introduced, which is really affecting agriculture. In fact, every major industry in North Queensland is presently being affected by legislation supposedly designed to save the reef, when the reef is at record high coral cover and is a most brilliant unspoiled ecosystem that you could ever imagine.
And then furthermore, agricultural pesticides are also being blamed for the reef die-off. Have you done any research in this area?
I've never done any measurements on that myself, but you can read all the reports and you read the reports and yeah, they say, oh, pesticides are a big problem. When you actually go out on the Great Barrier Reef and you look at the data, they almost never try to measure the pesticides on the Great Barrier Reef, which is a long way offshore, because they're in such low concentrations, you can't even measure them with the most ultra, ultra sensitive scientific equipment. Even when you come very close to the coast, near the mouths of the rivers where the pesticides will be coming out, even there, they're almost always in unmeasurable, so low concentration you can't measure them. They very occasionally get to a point where, you know, that they are close to the lowest point where they might have an effect on just one or two tiny little patches of coral next to the worst polluted river there is on the whole 2,000 kilometer coast. So even there, you know, it's just a tiny effect. There's nowhere on Earth, apart from the middle of the Pacific Ocean, I suppose, there's nowhere close to the coast which has had less impact from agriculture than this coast here. I suppose, you know, maybe the coastline near in Western Australia or some of those really remote areas in Canada where there is no agriculture. But this is an unaffected area by agriculture.
Interesting. So what is the biggest risk then to the reef? Is it natural processes like cyclone or hurricane?
That will kill more coral than anything, but it will recover. And of course, the system has been, you know, it's evolved with this. So that's what's meant to happen. The coral, the reefs, well, our reefs, not necessarily the reefs around the equator, which don't have cyclones, right? Because the cyclones don't get up there. But our reefs have grown up with these massive swings, and that's the ecosystem. But they're not a risk because it always grows back. We've seen this happen again and again and again. So they're in the longer term, of course, if you go thousands of years, when the climate cools, which it will ultimately due to the Milankovitch cycles, the sea level will fall and the reef will be gone again for another 20, 30 X, you know, 100,000 years or so.
But would it necessarily be gone, or is it just going to shift into deeper water? I mean,
Well, it will shift into deeper water, but it'll then become a big fringing reef system, because what the reef actually sits on what we call the continental shelf, which is the very flat seabed just offshore. And then when you go off that shelf, you sort of fall down a cliff. And what happened when the sea level was low was that the Great Barrier Reef really wasn't a Great Barrier Reef. It was just a fringing reef along this steep coastline. But can you imagine what the situation was when the sea level was, say, 25 meters lower than it is now? And all those reefs were islands, right? They were islands surrounded by coral. It would have been the 3,000 islands and make the Greek islands and some of your northern islands look like, trivial. This was the biggest island chain system on Earth, 2,000 kilometers long. It would have been a stunning situation. I'd love to be able to go back in time and see that.
And of course, probably some incredible diversity of species and probably some unique species amongst the various islands that may not have been interbreeding and so forth.
I think it probably would have been because of the way the ocean currents go, that it's all mixed in together, but it would have been very different. Would have been interesting to see what the Aboriginal people were doing at that stage. They would have been going out to those islands and probably living on those islands. We don't know, we can't tell because there's no, all the evidence has been washed away, but I can't imagine it not being the case.
Very interesting. So, Dr. Ridd, you've cast doubts about the standard of reef research by the scientific mainstream by linking this issue with the wider problem of the replication crisis in science generally. It seems to be beyond doubt that an awareness exists at the elite levels of the scientific community that there is indeed a plethora of studies and papers whose claimed results cannot be reproduced by other researchers. Why is this such a significant problem?
Well, the replication crisis is the biggest thing in science since, Einstein came up with the theory of relativity, and it's all bad. Because essentially what it's saying is that about 50% of the peer-reviewed scientific literature, all the new stuff that's appearing in journals, which you hear on the radio, etc., is wrong, right? 50% of the scientific literature, the new scientific literature, is wrong. And this isn't just me. This is coming out of all the big scientific academies. People like John Ioannidis from Stanford University have been saying this for a decade or two. And can you imagine any other profession that gets 50% wrong? Can you imagine buying a car off a used car dealer where only 50% of the cars actually ran? This is the scientific edifice, right? We are the most, and I hate to say this, and when I started to read up about the replication crisis in about 2013, it's in, it's in biomedical science, it's in the environmental sciences, in education, it's in everything. I literally went into a depression because I could see that I was proud to be a scientist. We were reliable, we were the good chaps. And then I realized, no, we're not. We're actually one of the most unreliable professions on earth. And it's not a good thing to be a scientist. And that's why when I started to read up about this, I realized, so the problem isn't, that these reef scientists are getting wrong or some climate scientists are getting wrong. What you could see was there was a fundamental quality assurance system in the way we're doing science. And this was causing problems in education, in biomedical, in climate, in reef. It's the whole thing. And that's why we have to look at the fundamental quality assurance problem to solve it. And by the way, it's the same in the COVID thing. It's exactly the same problem.
Yes, of course. I mean, it's and I've said many times in the show that climate change and COVID are inextricably linked and probably pushed by the same cadre of individuals. And so this is
But
what is
if I could interrupt, sorry, if I could interrupt there, Michael.
please.
But the important thing is that those sort of individuals can make use of it. But if it wasn't for the fact that the science was corrupted in the first place, we wouldn't be in the problem. So the fundamental problem there is the science was corrupted in the first place.
And so why is that? Is that simply so people can continue to receive grants? And is it this whole sort of corporatization of universities, or where does this problem stem from?
Well, peer review is part of the problem. Peer review, where you basically send your work to your peers to be judged, just make sure that groupthink will form. So what you end up with is, rather than a proper scientific system where people argue and debate, you end up with a quasi-mafia system, whereas you're a member of the group or you'll be excluded. And so it's not a proper system. And then, of course, the corrupting influence of money. If you want to get a grant, you've got to be part of the system. If you've been chucked out of the system, you won't be able to get money for to do any work. Now, I was lucky because I did a lot of commercial work for the university, and we were able to use the profits of that commercial work to continue on my research even after I'd been kneecapped by the Great Barrier Reef Mafia and had my funds cut off. I was still able to continue on doing that. This was in, about 2007 or 8.
So Martin Enceric wrote an article in Science, long and thoroughly researched piece, putting this into the mainstream in terms of the scientific establishment being corrupted. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, he was totally right. I mean, he was talking about the replication study, but he also, probably the same article, was talking about there was a replication study where, sorry, I should go back. Fundamental to science is the ability to replicate or repeat an experiment. You should, a different scientist should be able to get more or less the same results, doing more or less the same thing. So a group of scientists decided to do some replication studies on some coral reef work, demonstrating that supposedly that coral reef fish, their sense of smell and was being affected by carbon dioxide. Apparently they would swim towards their predators when they had too much carbon dioxide. It's crazy stuff. So these group tested this, and around about 10 of the papers this group produced were complete rubbish, right? They were totally wrong. So it was a replication study done. And of course, despite them showing that all this work was wrong, none of the work was retracted. The people who did the replication study and showed it was wrong, their careers will have suffered from that. So there's no brownie points or career enhancement for showing your fellow scientists have made a mistake. In fact, quite the opposite. That is career suicide to do that. So the replication crisis, this all this junk science just keeps persisting because the quality assurance systems aren't there to trap it out, and the incentive systems for it to continue on. And as I say, it's like a mafia being in science. If you get out of it, that's the end of your career.
Interesting. And of course, that's very anti-science not to have this debate and criticism and argue that I cannot reproduce the experiment, the hypothesis that you tested, I can't arrive at the same conclusions. Therefore, one of two of us have a problem. Let's invite a third to do the same. And if the third person can't achieve your results, then your results are not valid.
Exactly. And in fact, you can't get funding to do replication. I mean, you should be able to get funding to say, we want to replicate this study to see if it's right. Right? You can't. I tried in 2006 or so. I put in a grant to the Australian Research Council, and I was a heavy hitter with the Australian Research Council, getting a lot of money. Came back and said, no, this is not new work. You're only going to just to see if somebody else got it right. We wanted to have new work. So despite replication being fundamental to the scientific process, you can't generally get funding, though that is changing. In America and in the Netherlands and various other places, people are seeing that we do need to spend money on replication. This is actually an improvement in the quality assurance systems that we need. So a combination of the problems with the lack of quality assurance and these perverting influences of corruption due to the peer review system, you've got a disastrous situation in all of science. The good news is all that old science that you read in your old physics book, you can rely on it, okay? Dead solid. But a lot of this stuff that's coming out now, absolute junk.
So I mean, it's almost like having a bunch of footballers on the field without a referee there to keep the game in check.
Oh, if you want to use that analogy, I think it's that you've got the referee has fixed the match. That's basically what's happened.
Okay. So do you believe that we're at the point now that there needs to be a group of properly funded scientists whose sole job is to find fault within science, and upon which we're basing expensive public policy decisions?
Precisely. We need auditors. We need scientific auditors. We don't trust accountants to get the books right because we know dodgy business goes on in governments, in companies. So we send auditors in there to check to make sure. And they're specialists, right? That's their job. We need scientific auditors to go in. The question is, how do you fund them? And what do you fund them for? You don't need to fund it for industrial research because you know what? When an industry looks at a bit of science and decides whether they're going to use that to produce something or other, they test it themselves to make sure it works. Otherwise, they'll go broke. But governments don't test it. So, for instance, the new laws that we've got on the Great Barrier Reef to restrict farm pesticides and fertilizers, none of that has been tested. So we need to look at stuff that's being used for public policy. It might be code, it might be Great Barrier Reef, or whatever it is, and have a group of scientists who are somehow independent. But you can't necessarily have them government funded because if they're government funded, they're going to be corrupted too by exactly the same processes. So the question is, how do you set this up so that they don't get essentially captured by the same group that they're trying to audit? How do auditors, financial auditors, get around that problem? How do lawyers who are supposedly, you know, there's a prosecution and defense, how do you stop the defense lawyer having a quick chat with a prosecution lawyer and say, let's stitch this guy up, you know, because I think he's, there must be a way of doing it, but I'm not quite sure how you do that.
You know, if we look at the example of geology and mineral exploration, there's a very definitive set of guidelines in terms of the data collection, presentation, yeah, reproducibility. So I mean, maybe it boils down to the governing boards of the professions that step up to play that role in terms of the adjudication of data or the lawful means in which data can be collected, presented, and stored.
Nope. All the professions, all the big professional bodies are taken over, almost all of them, except for the geological ones, I must say. So you're talking about things like the JORC code, where the geologists look at mineral deposits and there's certain ways you're meant to look at it so that they don't. So, you know, somebody discovers a mineral deposit and the guy who wants to sell this mineral deposit says, oh, there's so much gold in here. We drilled some holes, we took some cores. There are guidelines about how you're meant to produce, present all that data. It's called the JORC code, I think. So that works very well. And that's the sort of thing we've got. But the professional bodies, for example, the Australian Academy of Science, and the Canadian one would be just as bad, has been totally captured by climate alarmists, by Great Barrier Reef alarmists. They know about the replication crisis. They know all about it, but they refuse to accept what the corollary must be. If we don't have enough quality assurance to get better than a 50% error rate, and by the way, we don't even know which 50%, we don't even know which 50% is the wrong bit. They know all that, but then they refuse to accept there might be a bit of a problem with the science which we use for public policy. So almost every major scientific institution, from the Royal Society to the Australian Academy of Science, they are caught up in the problem. They are part of the problem.
That's unfortunate. I mean, certainly going back to the geologic example, and we're talking about mineral exploration, you know, the reason that those rules are in place is so that a body or a company isn't able to defraud investors on a bogus project. Yet we have billions and trillions being poured into renewable energy projects and these other schemes, which essentially are based on junk science. And even when the net results of those projects come, which are negative for the consumer, we continue on with them unabated and look to add more capacity in that same vein of thought.
Precisely. I mean, if a geologist or a geological exploration company dodged up the data, they'd go to jail.
No.
They do go to jail occasionally. If in many fields, if you are willfully negligent, you don't deliberately do something that was dangerous, but you were deliberately not careful enough, right? And somebody gets hurt, you will go for jail. We have a system in science where we are willfully negligent because we know our quality assurance systems aren't up to scratch, because we know about the replication crisis. Nobody's going to jail. But there needs to be something that happens so that when this stuff is junk does come out, there is a consequence on somebody's career. There is a consequence to a particular organization that's made junk science, but there isn't. In science, people can be producing junk science for decades. Organizations can do it, and there is no consequence to them at all.
Interesting. I mean, obviously, the consequence ultimately is the taxpayers and citizens of the globe that suffer.
Yep, that's right. And particularly the children. That's what really worries me, because they're literally in depression at the moment about the future of the world.
Yeah, and certainly I had a friend over 2 weekends ago, and he brought his 8 and 11-year-old daughter along, and his wife was saying that, you know, the continuous doom and gloom that they're taught in school, they're looking to pull their girls out because they've had enough. You know, it's you know, mummy, like, you know, we're gonna die, and you know, and that's it seems to me that, so let's say in the 80s when this, or you know, I guess I wasn't aware of what was happening in the 70s, but in the 80s as this environmental movement took hold, it was different in its approach, and now it has really seemed to morphed into this doomsday cult, where, you know, it's there is no There is no upside. It's all downside, death and doom and gloom. And you know, humans have been around the Earth for a long period of time, and we're a rather ingenuitive group. And if we can't come up with a solution to move forward, I mean, I think that's selling ourselves short. And really, we should be more solutions focused than just this continued reinforcement of this negative paradigm.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, the climate's going to change, whether we change it or it does it by itself. It's going to change, and adaptation is the way to go. Adaptation to it is the way to go. I mean, one of the things that really genuinely scares me is what would happen if we had a major volcanic event, and these happen roughly every 500 years, where the climate will cool for a couple of years, right? And you might lose the complete Russian grain harvest for a whole year. At the moment, if that happened, and we're sort of looking down the barrel of that anyway,
with
the war over there, what's going to happen to the food supply? What's going to happen to 100 million Egyptians who are now dependent on that? So while we are scaring the children to death, you know, at least to suicide, about a tiny, gentle increase in temperature, which is largely, you know, beneficial. Right, we get to 5 degrees, it isn't, but you know, what we've seen so far is beneficial. And yet we're ignoring these things, which we should be worrying about and which we can plan for. It's very easy for us to store a year's worth of food. It's not a problem to do that, but we're not doing it, and it's a great shame.
For sure, for sure. And you know, certainly, again, you know, I don't know that the children being taught in this time that Hannibal crossed the Alps, and that wouldn't be possible today given the conditions there. So, I mean, this isn't an unprecedented change. And you know, in our human history, warming trends have been beneficial, cooling trends have been detrimental. And, you know, yeah, a bad Thursday 65 million years ago when the Chicxulub impact occurred, I mean, that was a very bad day. And so, you know, these things happen. And I think we need to be a bit more perspective in terms of, you know, our position in the world. I think some of this climate alarmism is also ego-based, that somehow humans have this capacity larger than life or larger than self that have the ability to alter climate, which clearly hasn't been proven.
No, well, I don't think it's been proven, but I think you're right. We need to be a bit more circumspect about the issues we face today, that in fact our children are growing up in by far the most wonderful era, you know, since humans came off the Serengeti plains in Africa. And yet we've managed to convince them that it's the worst time, that we're all going to die. I mean, this is child abuse.
Yeah. As they all clutch their smartphone and stare intently into it for 8 hours a day.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So let's look at your academic freedom case here. And I guess it all began following your contradictory opinion piece in the 2018 issue of Marine Pollution. Give us some details about this and what unfolded from there.
Well, essentially what I was saying, that I published this article, and we also, there was a news interview on one of the local Australian television stations. Well, essentially what I was saying was that due to the systemic quality assurance problems, like we've been talking about, systemic quality assurance problems, you couldn't trust the science coming out of a couple of institutions. I wasn't saying it was wrong. It's just that if you don't have QA, how am I supposed to tell whether this is any good, right? So I said that their work was untrustworthy. I couldn't rely on it. And I got hit with a disciplinary notice, which could get me fired. And because they said that I wasn't being respectful to my fellow scientists. We fought that because it was likely I was going to be fired. They then decided to search all my emails for where I'd spoken about this, because they also said, you're on a disciplinary charge, but we want you to keep this silent. We don't want you to tell anybody about it. Well, the word had sort of leaked out, and a couple of my emails I'd said to a couple of my students that, yes, I am up on a charge, but no, James Cook University, where I work, was no worse than all the universities. All universities clamp down on free speech. They pretend to value it, but actually they're Orwellian, you know, George Orwell, 1984, and they oppose free speech. So that was used as an example of where I denigrated the universities in general. So they read my emails and then said that I wasn't allowed to call the universities Orwellian, so they clearly didn't have a sense of irony. Anyway, we ended up in court. It ended up right to the highest court in the land, the High Court. Excuse me, I've got a frog in my throat here. And we half won and we half lost. So we basically were arguing on, I had intellectual or academic freedom. I was talking in the area of my expertise, and I should have been able to say the things that I said. The High Court ultimately agreed that the university was wrong to censure me for what I was saying on scientifically. But, and this was the perverse thing, they said the university had the right to fire me for talking about their illegal activity. So even though the university had acted illegally, they were still allowed to tell me to be silent about it. And I hadn't been silent about it because I couldn't be silent about it. One of the reasons was that, well, it was unfair. And secondly, we didn't think that's the way the work contract worked. But mostly, in order to get the $1.5 million of legal fees, you have to tell the people who are going to donate to you, and there was 10,000 people donated to my legal case, you have to tell them everything, everything, so they know that you're not a, you know, it's not sexual misconduct, it's what, it's, you know, really fair dinkum stuff. So I had to put everything out there. I redacted all the names and all that type of stuff. And the High Court said, no, when you did that, the university then had the ability to fire you. So even though you've got freedom of speech, they quoted John Stuart Mill and all those sort of things, they'd still allow the university to take away that freedom of speech, even though it was about talking about the university's own illegal activity. So it was a staggering situation. But the law is the law. It's not necessarily justice. It's the law.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, this situation may have a chilling effect on academic freedom of other researchers in other institutions.
Massive effect. And you're seeing this all around the world, especially in Canada and the US, that, you know, I often say, how many people does the Chinese Communist Party have to put in jail in Hong Kong to make sure all of those Hong Kong news outlets and everybody in Hong Kong knows, zip it, do not talk about it. You only need to lock up one or two people to make an example, and everybody else knows where the lie of the land is. And that's what's happened. So the irony is that the High Court has said, you do have academic freedom. You can talk about these things. But my goodness, you need to be all careful about exactly what you say. So it was sort of a mixed bag in terms of the decision. It's half good and it was half terrible.
Interesting. And then, of course, there's the interesting statement by the legal scholar Ronald Dworkin that any invasion of academic freedom is not only harmful in itself, but also makes future invasions more likely. Do you agree with that statement?
Absolutely right. I mean, universities are doing it all the time. We just never hear about it. We never hear about most of the occasions. And of course, there's a self-censoring. To be honest, most academics, they never say anything controversial enough to get them into trouble. But a few, you know, maybe 1 in 100, maybe 1 in 50 do. You don't need to make an example of too many of those for everybody else to fall in line. I mean, I know plenty of scientists who agree with a lot of what I'm saying on the Great Barrier Reef, but they are not stupid enough to actually say that because they saw what happened. I lost my job. And so they can't afford it. I'm at a stage of my life where losing the job was a bit of a bugger, but, you know, I could handle that. But if you've got a mortgage and kids at school, you just got to suck it up.
So obviously this is going to create a situation where more academics not willing to jeopardize their job are just going to toe the official line and not step out even if they feel or have information to the contrary.
Exactly. That's exactly what is happening. It's happening all over the world. Australia's probably no better, no worse than anywhere else.
Interesting. So this discussion wouldn't be complete if we didn't address the underlying motivation for the climate alarmist cult, which I believe is total control of the human population. Would you agree with that statement, and would you add anything to it?
I don't entirely agree with it. I think that there's a certain group of people, you know, the Davos set, who are certainly using it as a like that. But your average climate scientist or your average Great Barrier Reef scientist who believes the world is going to end, they're actually genuine. They most of those people genuinely believe it. I think they are, in the case of reef scientists, almost always over emotional about it. They're often quite good scientists, but the difference between me and them is that I fundamentally have lost trust in the scientific institutions, whereas they still have confidence in the scientific institutions. That's the difference between you and the believers, right? You might not have thought of it in this term, but you've lost confidence in the scientific institutions on COVID, on all these sorts of things. They haven't. They still believe them, right? Maybe their time will eventually come and they'll come over to our side, but they're not doing it to control the world. They genuinely believe it. But then you do have the Davos set, the people in the Greens, the people especially on the left-wing side of politics, who are most definitely using this as a pretext to do all sorts of other things which they would otherwise not be able to do.
Yeah, and certainly, and that's the group that I'm referring to, as opposed to the scientists who are sort of caught up in that situation. Now, given how easy it was for governments around the world to use scientifically baseless, hastily declared public health emergency and the powers that came from that to enforce drastic restrictions on citizens' freedoms, it doesn't take a tremendous amount of information in imagination to imagine that a similar legislation and actions might be enacted to deal with a perceived and false climate emergency. What do you think of that?
Well, it's already happening, isn't it? It's already happening, and it could get a lot worse. I'm sort of hopeful that as people start to reflect on the COVID thing and they realize just some of the dodgy business that went on, including, you know, the cover up of, in my view, almost certain leak from Wuhan, the just wrong information about how vaccines wouldn't spread. If you were vaccinated, you wouldn't spread the virus. These things which we now know that the scientific institutions knew this was wrong, but they said it anyway. As that maybe gets out, perhaps more of the younger generation who were most adversely and pointlessly affected by the virus. The older generation like me, it was dangerous, but for the younger generation, they were pointlessly affected. Maybe they will start to come around. Maybe this is the thing which will turn it around. I've got to keep being optimistic about it.
Yeah, I mean, I feel that the sub 25 age group have been very much captured by both the climate alarmism as well as the COVID narrative. And I think that's because, and especially in conversation with those younger 20 folks that I have, trying to shed some light on the climate alarmism, they are so indoctrinated from their, you know, lifetime of education / indoctrination, the education system, that it's pretty tough for them to see outside of that box. Are you seeing different situation in Australia there?
We certainly see it in Australia. It's everywhere. But I actually think that the younger people is where there's hope, actually. They are not all, they've certainly been brainwashed, but they also have a rebellious spirit. That's where the break is going to come. It's going to come from that age group. That's what I hope anyway. And that's why I'm running this group called Reef Rebels, where we're taking young people around the reef and trying to change their minds. And hopefully there'll be a penny drop moment where they suddenly realize, you know, we've been sold a complete crock of you know what here. And it will switch. It will switch. If it switches, excuse me, if it switches, it's going to happen incredibly quickly as they realize what's happened. And yes, the young people are totally indoctrinated on climate change. I suspect they're less indoctrinated on COVID, and maybe they will come around there, and that could be the catalyst for all sorts of things.
Well, that's good. And certainly, you know, historically, the youth have led these cultural rebellions or change. I mean, we saw the Arab Spring movement, which is largely run by university students. So I hope that your estimation are correct here. So I have to ask, you know, how do you suggest we convey these scientific facts of climate realism to the skeptics who are in the alarmist camp? And again, more importantly, these younger people.
Well, I think it's important to focus on the quality assurance problem, because that ultimately is the root cause. If the science was reliable, if we were doing science right, then the bad people would not be able to take advantage of it. The replication crisis, which is mainstream, right? Peter Reed's on the side, Willie Soon's on the side. You don't necessarily have to believe him because he's in a, you know, he's just a small guy. But replication crisis is mainstream. And you can make the argument that, well, heck, if half of biomedical science is wrong and you don't have the ideological problem there, why would you expect there not to be similar problems in climate science? So I do believe that we've got to keep on saying the words quality assurance, quality assurance, quality assurance. But we do need to focus on the young people, and we do need to try to communicate with them, because I do believe that ultimately is where the revolution will come from. Our generation and the generations either side of us did some fabulous things over the last 70 years. You know, we had the environmental movement, which was brilliant to start off with. We've made sure that homosexual and gay people are now not marginalized quite as badly as they used to be. We've done all these wonderful things, but we just went off the rails in the last 20 years. And the young people will do what our generations did eventually. We've just got to hope that's going to happen. I do truly believe it will happen. It's just a question of when. And, you know, it's not until the price of petrol goes up through the roof and you can't afford these things that the young people will start to think, is this really true? And delve into the facts themselves and look at the skeptical websites themselves. And then they will suddenly realize, my goodness, we've been fed a complete load of rubbish. And then it will happen.
Yes. And then, of course, I think one of the other elements here is real education rather than indoctrination, and a focus on evidence rather than ideology and belief. And I think this may be a cornerstone in terms of making positive changes in the minds of these young people.
But we're not going to get that out of our education system the way it is now. All our education systems are just a total disaster area. And one of the things that I think, if and when the change happens on climate, what you'll then see is a change in the way education is done as well, because people will be so cross that, you know, you've got these 30 or 40 year olds who've lived with this climate doom all all this time. And then they'll go about and say, how on earth did this happen? And that's when the changes will happen. Well, why was this in the curriculum at the school? Why did we allow the teachers to indoctrinate our children? You know, that's the great hope.
Yes, yes. And then are you aware of any other scientists similar to yourself that are still focused on real science and who value truth and evidence over anything else and may jeopardize their careers to promote the facts and real science?
Well, there are a few around. They tend to be older and more established. I mean, people like Roy Spencer, who's fabulous, but you can't cancel him because he basically invented the radiometers that measure the satellite, you know, data. So he's too big to cancel. But they're few and far between. And what you will see is papers where they will really do a really good paper. And if you read in between the lines, you can actually get the real information out of it. They may have to sort of pay lip service to the conventional wisdom, but there's still good information coming out from a lot of scientists, even if they're not saying, I'm a dyed-in-the-wool climate skeptic now. But you can sort of read it in between the lines there.
No, that's good. That's good. And so in conclusion here today, Dr. Ridd, what areas are you of research are you presently pursuing or plan to pursue?
Well, we're still working on the Great Barrier Reef, but mostly what we're doing is trying to get the message out to young people. So I'm going to be working on a whole bunch of videos. As I said, we've got this Reef Rebels program going where we're showing young people the reef, but also just continuously working on the quality assurance thing. That is our problem. It's a quality assurance problem. No point in working on any more science now for me, because that's not, if the whole systems are wrong, then unless that is sorted out, you can never improve things. So that's essentially what I'm doing with the Institute of Public Affairs here in Australia.
Interesting. And just doing my research for the show here, it seems that the IPA seems to be a somewhat controversial agency. Is that because they're shedding light into dark corners that makes people uncomfortable, or what's the hesitation there?
Well, it's, I mean, to a lot of people, the Institute of Public Affairs is a quasi-fascistic organization. You know, that's what you'd think. But they're just a free market think tank that believes in free speech and, you know, some libertarian values. But of course, in today's world, unless you're hard left, then you're equated with, you know, some terrible people. So they're just, a sort of right of center think tank. But they have certainly taken up the climate issue in a fairly major way, but also now this wider thing of quality assurance, because it's not just climate that this is affecting us.
Interesting. So obviously a thorn in the side of the establishment and the mainstream narrative. So that's their an organization to be feared from those people.
Oh yes, they certainly fear the IPA. That's why you get this extreme reaction. So if you can't deal with somebody's argument, you just say, "Oh, they're alt-right," or, you know, some other epithet. So yes. This is what I find all the time. They'll say, "Oh, I'm in the pay of the coal industry or some other industry," because you say that, then you don't have to deal with my arguments, you know. So I say, "Well, there's no pesticides measurable on the Great Barrier Reef," and their response is, "Well, you're in the pay of the whichever industry." Right? Yeah. You know, you've won the argument when that happens, but unfortunately the message doesn't get out as well as it could.
Yes, yes. And then finally, Dr. Reid, how can listeners learn more about you and your work? Where would I direct them?
Well, we're developing a bunch of videos at the moment. There's not a huge amount of stuff. I've got a bit of a YouTube channel where we're putting a few things up. Probably just Google and have a read of that. And there's a book called Reef Heresy, which I've written, which is by Connor Court. And that basically looks at all the science of the Great Barrier Reef in a sort of a quasi layman's terms, I hope, and will make you come out much more optimistic about the state of the Great Barrier Reef, I think.
Okay, and is that available on Amazon and all the usual channels?
Yeah, usually. If you just Google Peter Reid Reef Heresy book, you'll find it.
Okay, excellent. All right, sir. Well, thank you so much for your time. It's been an outstanding and interesting discussion. I value your time today, and thank you for all the work you're doing. We need more brave scientists like yourself to speak out and challenge the mainstream propaganda.
Thanks very much.